Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CPRMetro.org. And I'm excited. I might be the only one on earth excited, but I'm excited because this is our fifth anniversary. And I think you loyal listeners and supporters of the Soapbox know it's been quite a struggle to get us to this point, but I am fundamentally and profoundly proud of Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and the shows that we produce every week. And so I just want to say congratulations to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and myself, and thank everybody who support and have helped work on the show over these past 5 years. This year is going to be no different from the other 4 years. We're going to provide very many interesting topics with amazing and interesting guests. And today we're going to be talking about the Saudi Arabia connection to 9/11 with our friend John Gold. And then we'll be talking to Icelandic parliamentarian Birgitta Jónsdóttir. And she is going to be dispelling the myths of what Iceland has done or hasn't done to the banksters there, and talking about some exciting initiatives that she's involved with. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with John Gold. Our first guest on this very special edition of the Soapbox is our friend John Gold. John Gold describes himself as an advocate for 9/11 justice. John Gold, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me on to talk about this important issue, Cindy.
And it's our fifth anniversary show. Whoop, whoop.
Awesome. Congratulations.
And people have to know, too, you're not just a 9/11 justice advocate, but you're a friend of mine, and you are actually do a lot of volunteering for Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. So very grateful to you for that for the past few years.
It's been my pleasure for the past few years, and I'll continue to do so.
It's taken a lot of us to keep this show going, that's for sure. So, John Gold, I am also a 9/11 I would say I'm more like a truth advocate, although I am very into the justice angle also, because I would love to see justice for my own son's death and for millions of people who have suffered in Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is just since 9/11, Yemen, where, you know, Libya, Syria, wherever the empire reaches. But, you know, you and I always have this little debate, because every day you write on your Facebook wall, "We were lied to about 9/11. And I always say we were lied to about everything. And, well, hold on. I want to go a little bit further with this question. You know, capitalism, the empire, all the lies kill at least 30,000 people a day because of poverty and starvation. So, and I understand your point, but tell my listeners why this 9/11 issue is so important today in 2014 now. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Well, just to give an example, just the other day, a judge ruled that the NSA wiretapping was legal.
Mm-hmm.
They did that by using 9/11 as the justification for it. I mean, that's just a recent example, but in the post 9/11 world, it seems that everything that we hate that's happening right now, the drone strikes, the warrantless wiretapping, the torture, it's all justified by 9/11. So yes, we've been lied to about everything, but I think it's important to point out the fact that we were lied to about 9/11 so as to take away the justification that they so often use.
Right, right. And, you know, I do get that, but, you know, they dropped two atomic bombs on Japan because of the lie of Pearl Harbor. So, you know, it's just like, I guess it's important because people also, like, you didn't want me to call you a 9/11 truth seeker because you say it's so demonized. It's yeah, like saying somebody is a mass murderer if you say they're a 9/11 truth seeker.
Well, no, the phrase 9/11 truther has been demonized by the media for the last 6 or 7 years. They've made it the equivalent of a baby killer or a dog torturer. And I believe that's one of the reasons many progressives that we know refuse to touch the 9/11 issue, because they don't want to be painted with the 9/11 truth brush.
Right.
They don't want to lose their pulpits.
Right. Well, of course, they made 9/11 truthers seem worse than baby killers because they support almost everything that baby killer Obama does.
Well, I coined the phrase 9/11 truther, and when I did, the meaning that I had for it was somebody that supports the 9/11 family members seeking justice and accountability, somebody that supports the 9/11 first responders who were sick and dying and that required health care, and someone that tries to stop everything that's happening in the post 9/11 world by using the truth, something that we've been denied by our government. That was the original, quote, definition of what a 9/11 truther is. But they've destroyed it.
Well, you have some horrible health problems that have confined you. Confined your movements, but you were in the hospital for a while, and while you were in the hospital, a judge ruled that 9/11 members of victims' families could sue Saudi Arabia?
Right.
Could you tell my listeners more about that?
I sure can. Well, for years, the 9/11 family members tried to bring about litigation against the Saudis for the part they had to play in the 9/11 attacks. But they were blocked by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Now, from a report from ABC News, it says a new ruling struck down an earlier decision that found Saudi Arabia immune from lawsuits. The second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said it's in the, quote, interests of justice to allow them to proceed. So now 9/11 family member William Doyle said that he's ecstatic that he can finally get 9/11 into the courts. And another development that's taken place recently is that Representatives Stephen Lynch and Walter Jones introduced a resolution urging President Obama to make public 28 pages from the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 that remain secret. Those 28 pages have to do with Saudi Arabia's connection to the attacks. So what I've done is I've gathered a list of 11 points of interest having to do with Saudi Arabia and 9/11. And the reason I did this was because I want to make sure this information is available to people, because I do not think the corporate media is going to cover it as they should.
Well, you have been long on the case of Saudi Arabia, haven't you?
Well, Saudi Arabia is but one part of the cover-up of 9/11. There's a multitude of cover-ups regarding 9/11, but we're going to focus on Saudi Arabia. And if you want me to read this list of information, I want to preface this by saying that I do not advocate war against Saudi Arabia. I believe individuals responsible should be held accountable and not entire countries. Otherwise, you will see thousands upon thousands of innocents murdered for a crime they didn't commit, like we've seen in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere. So I want to make sure everybody understands that before I start into my list.
Okay.
All right. So number one, in late January 2001, after the elections, and by the way, I'm going to make all of this information available to Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. In late January 2001, after the elections, intelligence agencies are told to, quote, back off, end quote, from investigating the bin Ladens and the Saudi royals. Reporter Greg Palast notes that President Clinton was already hindering investigations by protecting Saudi interests. However, as he puts it, quote, where Clinton said go slow, Bush policymakers said no go. The difference is between closing one eye and closing them both, end quote. Number two, the famous Jersey Girls released a petition in 2006 calling for the release of those 28 redacted pages from the Joint Congressional Inquiry, as well as other pertinent information. They managed to collect over 17,000 signatures. The media ignored them, and so did our government. Number three, the 28 redacted pages is just the tip of the iceberg. The 9/11 Commission has yet to release all of their documents, and many of the memorandums for the record, or MFRs, that they have released are greatly redacted. An MFR that has not been released is that of former Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar. Now, just so everybody knows, an MFR is just an interview sheet that goes over what staffers spoke about with witnesses. Now, number four, the two hijackers that former Senator Bob Graham mentions in San Diego were living with an FBI informant by the name of Abdusattar Sheikh. Between April 3rd and 7th, 2001, three hijackers were given visas to the United States through the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. They are Nawaf al-Hazmi, Salam al-Hazmi, and Khalid al-Midar. Al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi are, quote, already al-Qaeda veterans and battle-hardened killers, end quote. All three men have indicators in their passports marking them as Islamist radicals. These indicators are used to track them by the Saudi authorities, but are apparently not notified by U.S. officials. Now, there are many other questions about how the hijackers obtained their visas. I suggest people look up Michael Springman and the Visa Express program. Now, the 9/11 report said that the source of the funding for the attacks was, quote, of little practical significance, end quote. I think that's very significant, don't you? Number 10. According to former New York Times reporter Phil Sheenan, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow, and team leader Dieter Schnell took part in a late-night editing session to delete any passages within the 9/11 report having to do with Saudi support for the hijackers. Now, this is only one reason that I believe Philip Zelikow needs to be invested thoroughly. In fact, I think he belongs in jail. Now, number 11, and this is the final point. In November 2007, Prince Bandar will make the claim that Saudi intelligence was, quote, actively following, end quote, most of the hijackers with, quote, precision, end quote. There is a multitude of information out there that suggests the Bush administration was well aware that the attacks were coming. Even though he says he didn't, personally, I wonder if Bandar shared any of this information with anyone within the Bush administration. And that's the final point, and I just have one thing to say. I would just like to say that I cannot recommend enough the website historycommons.org and their complete 9/11 timeline. I will make this, as I said, I will make the information I said it available on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. The information I provided is just the beginning. The cover-up of Saudi Arabia is just one cover-up having to do with 9/11. There are many more.
Well, John, thank you. And you do have links and backup information for all of those points that people can access. And my question is, how are the you know the families, you don't know all the families, but you are in communication with a lot of families. How are they going to move forward with this information and with the news that they are able to sue Saudi Arabia now?
Well, what I'm hoping is now that 9/11 will be allowed in the courts with regards to Saudi Arabia, that information like this is brought to light. during the proceedings. I am not sure how they are going to go forward with this. I do know that they're extremely excited about it, because in a way, I'm hoping that it opens up a can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you bring Saudi Arabia into the mix, you can bring in everything else, the CIA, the fact that NORAD lied, a whole bunch of things that you can bring up in a courtroom. So I hope that's what they plan on doing. But again, I don't know the route they're going to take.
Well, also, there's a little known case, if you only pay attention to the corporate media, that there's a woman in Iraq who's suing George Bush and Dick Cheney in federal court. And that's a little known case, although the attorney, Indar Komer, has been on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. But, you know, I'm happy that this might lead to justice for the 9/11 families, but also, you know, we need justice for the troops that have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need justice for the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm just wondering how we can proceed with that, you know, to go forward with that.
Well, once we take away the justification for the post 9/11 world, I'm hoping that we get justice for everybody, the families, the people of the world. You know, we were all attacked that day. And I think that once we take away that justification, once we take away their 9/11 card, they can no longer use it. And that may open up the door to bring the troops home, you know, to bring accountability for the torture that we've seen. It would hopefully reverse all legislation that we despise in the post 9/11 world. At least this is my hope. I know that it could be considered a pipe dream, but I have to keep fighting.
Well, we just recently saw the extension or reauthorization of the NDAA.
Right, the NDAA. And indefinite detention is still part of the NDAA, from what I read. This has got to stop. You know, we've been doing this for years, Cindy.
You can't say the S. No, you're right. The crap has to stop.
Yep. It has to stop. There's still killing going on in the world. I mean, look at Iraq. I mean, look what we did to Iraq. There are people dying there, what it seems like, every day now.
Right. And I hear we're selling them more arms to help them fight the so-called extremists.
Yeah, we're selling them drones.
Right.
To help them against Al-Qaeda. You know, and the definition of Al-Qaeda to me is anything our government needs, whenever and wherever it needs it to be. You know, any dissenter considered Al-Qaeda.
Well, I have 2 points about selling arms to Iraq and Al-Qaeda. First of all, there was no Al-Qaeda, and I use air quotes, in Iraq before, you know, we invaded in 2003. If they're there now, I don't know. But secondly, we're arming elements of Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Right.
We're arming Iraq, the government of Iraq, to fight so-called Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Right. Do you remember when Bush used to say, we're fighting them over there,
right,
so we don't have to fight them over here?
Right.
They chose the battlefield of Iraq.
Right. That's whatever.
What you said.
That's yeah. Big fat liar.
Yeah, big fat liar that belongs in jail.
So, you know, and that's the thing, too, is, you know, George Bush is not the problem. He was a problem. Obama has continued many and expanded the policies of the Bush regime. So, you know, it's the empire that needs to be overthrown.
Yep, the empire needs to be overthrown. Cindy Sheehan for governor, 2014.
And, you know, if we say Bush needs to be in jail, then Obama and his administration need to have a joining cells.
of course.
So they can play Crazy Eights together for the rest of their lives.
Yep. They both belong in jail. So many people in D.C. belong in jail. Anybody that served the corporations over the people, I mean, they belong in jail as far as I'm concerned.
Well, can you think of anything worse than being in jail and adjoining cell with George Bush and Dick Cheney for the rest of your life? So anyway, John, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and I just wish you the best for this year, continued healing, and, you know, keep going with your advocacy, because I think that is the surest way for healing and to go forward.
Thank you so much, Cindy, and I love you very much.
I love you too, John. Thanks for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox again. Our next guest is Birgitta Jonsdottir. I had a lot of fun interviewing her. She's got a very wonderful personality. And before she became a member of the Icelandic Parliament in April 2009, she worked as a writer, artist, activist, web developer, and designer. She says that she's everything but your traditional politician. She's a poetician, which I love. Her political views are not expressed because she thinks that politics are something beyond her everyday life. Politics is life. Being political is having opinions. Every person has the opportunity to change the world. And that is Birgitta Jonsdottir's philosophy. Birgitta Jonsdottir, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me a chance to stand on the soapbox.
Well, thank you. And thank you for your commitment. I know you're a huge advocate for transparency, internet freedom, and whistleblowers, but also for peace. You've been a long-time peace activist, haven't you?
Yes, I have, ever since I can remember, actually. So I was fortunate enough to have a mother that was very active in the peace movement in Iceland. And she was also Iceland's first woman to be so-called troubadrix. She made music to her own songs and would travel around Iceland playing for, you know, working class people, old people, and anybody that wanted to listen to her. But she made music to the most amazing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
By Icelandic poet. So I started on very early to understand the fundamentals in life.
You are very fortunate. I didn't start, and I always felt this way, but I didn't start being an activist till my son was killed. And I often think, you know, what would it have been like if, you know, things were different? But you can't look back. You can only look forward.
Exactly. I mean, I think the biggest change in my life was actually when my father died. I was around 20.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me go into a very profound soul search to try to understand what I needed to do in order to both go beyond my own self-destruction. But most importantly, how could I learn from this to be a better person?
Mm-hmm.
I've been fortunate. Often people think that tragedies are bad, but you know, as difficult as they are when you are feeling them, it is just like in society, the only time in our lives when we're ready to take on profound change.
Right. Well, it's first of all, unfortunately, tragedy, heartbreak is a human condition, but I think the victory or the healing of that comes with our personal response to it.
Yeah, exactly.
There are so many ways we can go, and I think that's where we have a choice on which way are we going to go. So, once in a while when I have an extremely interesting guest, and you're one of those times, All my guests are interesting, but sometimes I have extremely interesting guests. And I would like to thank you also because you're going to be our featured guest on our 5th anniversary show. So thank you so much for that. But
wow.
I know, I can't believe we've been on for 5 years already. I open it up to my supporters and listeners to ask questions. And you're one of my Facebook friends, so you were involved in this discussion on my Facebook wall yesterday. But as you see, there's a lot of people who were very interested and asking you questions. Now, here in the United States and all over the internet, you know, especially Facebook, there's a lot of memes about how Iceland really made those evil bankers pay for what they did to the country, but that's not exactly true, is it? And I think that I'd like to hear, 'cause we need a good model of what to do in these situations, but we need true models, not fake legends. So, Birgitta, could you tell my listeners about what really happened in Iceland over the horrible economic collapse?
Yes, I can, and I'm very pleased that I can maybe break some of the myths. I mean, a lot of good things happened, but not all of the myths are true. So I'm going to just go through it state by state because I know people are looking for inspiration, and I totally agree with you. It is so important that the inspiration is based on facts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first thing that happened was that the government that was sitting during the financial collapse desperately tried to bail out the banks. They went seeking for loans with our allies and friends, but our allies and friends said, no, we're not going to give you money so that you can carry on in this insanity. So we didn't receive any loans, and thus there had to be a plan B. And then this plan B was actually quite good because it meant that we did not bail out the banks because we simply couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that people understand that prior to the collapse in Iceland, 5 years earlier, the banks were privatized. And in that process, something criminal happened. The new bank owners didn't really buy them. They just lent each other money for the first payment.
Right.
And so the level of corruption was so deep, despite the fact that on the index for corruption, Iceland was ranked the least corrupt country. And I remember when I saw that, I couldn't believe my eyes. I didn't know if I should cry or laugh.
I know.
I did both. Because we're very tiny, there are 320,000 people living in Iceland. Our economy is very fragile. So during the times of privatization, the banksters used a loophole because we are not a part of the EU, but we are part of the EEA, the European Economic Area, which means that 80% of our laws are EU laws. And so when people say we shouldn't join the EU, we are sort of in the EU without the privileges of actually being able to impact any lawmaking.
Uh-huh.
So that's one myth that I need to shatter as well. So they used the loophole in the EEA law and created banks in other countries. And then a very incredible Ponzi scam started. And by the end of it, they had expanded the debt to 5 times our GDP, just in 5 years.
Wow.
Unbelievable. And, of course, it can never be justified that these debts would be rolled over on the taxpayers' shoulders. But that was the intention of the previous government, that the people then actually were so shocked because, like, it was because we are small, they managed somehow to keep the banks open, so there wasn't like a massive run on any banks or anything like that. But because of what happened, we were faced with something like a complete discredit in the rest of the world. And the British government used an anti-terrorist law on Iceland, which led to none of the Icelandic companies or others that had credit lines, could have any credit lines, and living on an island and facing food and medicine shortages did not help. And we were forced during this very sensitive time to sign a memorandum of understanding that we would roll over the so-called ISIV accounts onto the shoulders of the nation. And I can sort of understand the previous finance minister, like, sitting with all the big cats at the EU, at this special meeting, being faced with either I sign this memorandum of understanding or there will not be food in Iceland.
Wow.
And so he did. But in it, there was, like, the ironic part was that the British and the Dutch government, both being previous colonist nations, treated us like their previous colony, even if we were not theirs, ever. And smeared a lot of interest on this debt that they wanted the Icelandic nation to acknowledge as a national debt instead of a private debt. And so that was one thing that we managed to actually stop. And that was through a joint, that was because of the people of Iceland. That was not solely resting on the Icelandic president. And it is important that people understand that the Icelandic president is merely a cookie decoration. He is not like the US president. He is like, because we have an old constitution that is recycled from the Danish, which they were our colonists until 1944, he is sort of like a king rather than a president.
Uh-huh.
And it is the government, the governmental body that makes all the main decisions. But after he had been sort of partying quite wildly with the banksters, the Icelandic oligarchs, and praising them, so he was very unpopular at the time, after the collapse. So his only choice was, when the nation pleaded with him to not sign, his role is to sign laws,
uh-huh.
not to sign it, his only choice to regain some sort of grace was to do the bidding of the nation. There was a massive campaign to get to stop this, because if we would have acknowledged this debt, we would have gone bankrupt. And not only that, like, almost all our income tax would have gone into only paying the interest of this debt. So this was massive stuff, and we managed to get actually national referendums twice on the ISAFE contract. We did not, and we haven't been able, this is very complicated, to get the banksters into jail.
Right.
They have been sort of charged, but they're taken into higher courts. There were quite a heavy sentencing quite recently, but they're not yet in prison. And there have some people been put into prison, but they get very easily off, like, you know, their prison terms and so forth. We have a very different justice system in Iceland. So life in prison is only 16 years, and you usually only serve that time, half that time.
Uh-huh.
But compared to Icelandic prison sentencing, the newest and the biggest ruling was for 5 years, which is quite big in Iceland, but in my opinion, for, you know, they ruined so many people's lives.
Right.
There are people that will never recover from what happened here, and so I think they're getting off actually quite light. But I would prefer to see the white collar criminals actually go into community work for the rest of their lives,
uh-huh.
You know, working as garbage collectors or whatever. Because, you know, I think that, you know, at some states, our laws are actually, we have to acknowledge that all the laws in the world, and this is what I've discovered since I became a parliamentarian, all the laws in our world are not written by the people that are representing. It is written by lobbyists.
Right.
And it is this perfect marriage between the corporate and the state that is one of the big factors in killing our societies.
Well, if we believe in restorative justice, then, you know, the so-called punishment fitting the crime, you know, makes more sense. Like, people think that George Bush and Dick Cheney should be executed for war crimes, but I think they should probably be put to work mopping floors in Iraqi orphanages or something like that. I think that would be, I mean, but I don't know, would that punish the people of Iraq even more to have to see their ugly faces every day? We don't need
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we don't need to punish them anymore. Well, you know, I'm glad you're talking about this, because the image that we get here in the United States is you have banksters chained to the walls in dungeons there. And, you know, researching this, you know, our interview, I found that it's quite different, but I think it's quite different because it's more quaint to your system. You don't have a lot of white collar crime, so you don't have any people that, you know, really know how to prosecute it, or any laws that, are, you know, relevant to what happened in Iceland. But is that why you ran for parliament and, through this whole scandal?
I sort of just randomly happened to enter into parliament. I, of course, never had any aspiration to be a politician. That's why I define myself rather as an activist or a politician.
I love that, politician. That's great.
So, but I feel like because I was one of the very few people that was constantly protesting during the good times in Iceland. So I had been upholding protests for 9 months outside the Chinese embassy because of their treatment of Tibetans. And so when the collapse came, I was the only sort of super known protester. So everybody was sort of calling me and asking me, where do I get megaphones? And do you need permits for this? And so I immediately sort of got involved in helping with the protests, and was a part of a think tank that was created by a very diverse group of people on what we needed to do in order to prevent this from happening again. And this think tank sort of developed into a coalition of different grassroots movements. And in the end, we all felt that in order to achieve true change, we needed to go inside the system to change, to legalize direct democracy, and to make, you know, some legal tools so that we didn't have to stand and protest and throw food at the house in order to get rid of a government. And actually at some states, the protests were actually transforming into violence, which is very uncommon in Iceland because we are a nation, you know, our police doesn't even carry guns, and we don't have a military. So, but one of the main things that I felt were important, and was one of the reasons I sort of helped co-create this political movement, was that I felt that we needed to change our constitution, and I felt it, that the people needed to do it, and I felt that it was important to create a new bridge into parliament that was a bridge between the general public and this place of power. And I also, you know, I felt it was very important to work on transparency and freedom of information legislation, and so forth, and accountability. So these were sort of my things. I also promised to be the annoying fly in the tent if I would get in there, and I certainly have.
Right.
And, but yeah, so we actually, after the collapse, some of the really interesting thing that happened was that I actually, like, we got 7.2% of the vote, my political movement, on no budget. 8 weeks prior to elections we were created, I decided to run in my constituency like a month before the elections, and I was sort of shocked when I realized that I was sort of a public figure all of a sudden. And but this demand for a new constitution is not new. There, actually, the current constitution was always temporary constitution. But the people in power do not want the general public to make the constitution.
Right.
So despite this fact, we did a beautiful project, the Icelandic people. And so the previous government that was just elected out of the parliament in April this year, they set out with a little help from my political movement to start this quest for having the people participate in discussing and shaping the new constitution. And the beauty of doing that is, like, even like in the United States, you have, you know, a good constitution, but most people don't understand all the rules that have been applied to it.
Right.
So you might have a really good sort of basis, but there has been no discussion about all the additional rules that fit in with the constitution. So you never know if somebody is breaking it or not. Like, I participated in suing Obama for additions to the NDAA last year, which are very dangerous additions, giving the military the right to arrest anybody anywhere on the suspicion of terrorism without trial and everything. So I participated in this project with Chomsky and Chris Hedges and many other great people.
Right.
And we won, and then we lost, of course.
Right.
Usually, you know, the first states of justice is relatively good, and then you have to start to question the higher up you go, less justice is available. And of course, laws are written by and for the first, for the 1%, because they are the people that help create the laws, and they always evade the laws. It's a very interesting coincidence. But the constitutional process is so important, not only for us here in Iceland. It is a discussion about what sort of society you want to be. And every generation has the right to discuss this, because we might shift and change our perspectives and focuses, even if, like, of course, there is always certain amendments that are just sort of holy, you know, like privacy. Oh, I forgot. It's been broken so badly that you don't know what it is
anymore. It's not holy anymore. It's holy, but it's H-O-L-E-Y, not H-O-L-Y. It's filled with holes. Mm-hmm.
And so in the, like, in the constitutional process, we did everything right, you know, apart from, of course, doing lots of mistakes because we're doing this for the first time. And those that were against the process made sure to try to use all the tiny errors to destroy the legitimacy of the project. And so in the end, this beautifully crafted new constitution has been thrown into the shredder just in the last few days of the last parliament. And the young new leaders of the new of the left, they were fooled, and they by the now current ministers that run the country. So it was a shame, but I think it is important to bear in mind, even if we didn't finalize it, we still have that document.
Right.
And we had also some really other sort of profound changes. And I think perhaps one of the most important changes in our societies was that the old structure of the parties is sort of eroding and collapsing. We usually have 5 parties in parliament. We now have 6.
That's awesome.
I ran for the Pirate Party, which I helped create in Iceland, which is a party focusing on 21st century legislation in relation to privacy, freedom of information and expression, copyright reform, and direct democracy. And these are all things that are very, very important to me. And just the fact that Iceland is the first country in the world to elect pirates in their parliament is a sign that we are still relatively open-minded. We also had an incredible mayor that is going to quit. For the biggest city in Iceland, an incredibly brilliant installation artist and a comedian who put humanity and humanitarian work as his main focus. He would have been easily reelected as a mayor, but he decided to quit. It was just too painful to be around all these dishonest people.
Oh, yes. It takes a toll. Yeah. It takes a toll, doesn't it?
And but I think that maybe the most the thing that I am the proudest to have gotten through the parliament and the way it sort of happened was the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, which was a parliamentary proposal. And a parliamentary proposal usually entails that you task a government to write laws and then push them through the parliament. In this particular parliamentary proposal, which was to make Iceland into a safe haven for freedom of information, expression, and speech, which I worked with people from all over the world, and the people that helped the most with it were from WikiLeaks, at the time a relatively unknown organization.
Uh-huh.
And so they knew how to keep stuff up no matter what. And the main focus was to ensure that news and information belonging in the public domain could be up and running, no matter what sort of legal threats there would be, and to create proper whistleblowing laws and proper protections for both media and sources, and encouragement. And somehow I got this through the parliament with a wall of green. Everybody said yes. And this has never happened in the history of the parliament of Iceland, that a parliamentary proposal that is actually course defining where we're heading as a nation is passed. And not only that, the laws are being made, which is pretty remarkable. And it just goes to show that, you know, anything can happen if you're at the right time and you believe in, you know, what is important and there is enough brain power behind it to encourage and support it.
Well, Birgitta, unfortunately we're running out of time, but you're an awesome interview because you answered all my questions without me even having to ask them. So I told you we were on the same wavelength. But
yep.
I just want to say, you know, I'm running for governor of California. I didn't know if you knew that, but, you know, this is where California must be 100 times bigger than Iceland. I don't know. We have about 40 million people in California.
Wow.
Our capital city is bigger than Iceland, but, you know, we want to use these things that you're doing, you know, and the other successful models around the world, you know, like Venezuela actually did rewrite their constitution. The people wrote it, you know, and it has to be a document that is, I think, relevant to the people and relevant to today. So I'd like you to get the California Pirates Party to endorse me for governor.
All right. I now solemnly urge them to do so.
Well, you know.
It is, like you said, it is very important that we focus on solutions. And we have to create a new hardware for our systems so that we can actually put our new systems into something that will run them. And that means downsizing.
Absolutely. So you are a poetician and you have a wonderful website. Can you tell my listeners your website?
So if they want to find all my stuff, they go to Birgitta.is. And it's a portal to all my different spaces in cyberspace. And my personal homepage I started to make in 95. It's very personal, lots of poetry, photos, art, and my thoughts. So feel free to enter my private living room.
Yes. So we do have to downsize, but with your help and the help of other people on this planet, hopefully we can still stay connected to each other with this open internet, and but also for privacy, or privacy, as you say, to be paramount. But we need to stay connected to each other.
Absolutely. And for if you want to use any of the IMI suggestions, the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, you can go to immi.is and feel free to use whatever you want to. We are in the co-creation together.
And this show is also Creative Commons, where it can be used, like you say, as long as people, acknowledge and give us credit that it's the information we want to get out. I think it's so important that open source be our goal.
Exactly. Well, good luck with, your running for senator and
governor.
I'm running for president.
President of California, the Republic of California. So, Birgitta Jonsdottir, awesome. Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. It was really great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that's the wrap-up of our fifth anniversary show here at Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I had asked some friends of the show and friends of mine to record congratulations for this show, and nobody did, actually, except for Dr. Helen Caldicott. And due to the service of something I'm not using anymore, we lost her recording. But Dr. Helen Caldicott is an amazing person, and also the show I did with her last year was the most listened to show on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. So again, I guess I'll just have to congratulate myself for the past 5 years and be proud of the show that we present to you every single week. Well, most weeks, unless I'm in jail or riding my bike across the country. As always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar for being the engineer in connection to CPR Metro. I'd like to thank my producer, Mikey Kim, my on and off producer, for arranging the interview with Birgitta. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening and for supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.